VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Welcome to The Game Podcast. I'm Alison Rudd, standing in for Gabriel Marcotti. This week, I'm joined by my favourite Times writers, Tom Dart, James Ducker and Matthew Syed. Today, we'll discuss what happened at Eastlands and whether Liverpool have begun their fight back after defeating what has to be said was a poor Rovers side. Plus, it's been a turbulent few weeks for the game. We'll be debating whether football still has any morals. Okay, so what on earth happened at Eastlands? 3-0 victory by Arsenal. Arsene Wenger says, we can win the title. This is a turning point. Team seems to have grit away from home. But does it really mean anything when Manchester City were down to 10 men for the vast bulk of the match? I'll go first to Matthew, because I think you felt it was sort of a bit of a shame and no conclusions can be drawn. Is that right, Matthew?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to draw any legitimate conclusions because of the sending off. I thought the sending off was justified. I thought the referee got it right. But what would have been a fascinating encounter and a really good opportunity to measure the relative merits of two very good teams, it was spoiled, really, I think, for the neutral. Arsenal pressed home to advantage well, always going to be able to exploit one man down with their passing. Fabregas, as ever, the weighted through passes that he made were symptomatic of one of the true geniuses of the Premier League. I thought Nasri was good as well, but I actually thought Manchester City were very good with 10 men. They rather surprisingly, didn't lose their attacking intent, which surprised me. I thought they'd be more organised and more defensive, but I thought they were resilient, and I don't think it necessarily means that Manchester City are any less of a threat this season than we thought before the match.
James, did you feel we learnt more about Arsenal or more about Manchester City in that
setup? I don't think we really learned a great deal about Arsenal, to be honest. I agree entirely, really, with what Matthew said. It's very, very difficult to kind of judge in what kind of direction these two teams are headed when one of the teams plays for 85 minutes with 10 men and the other doesn't. I would go back to the two performances against Chelsea that these teams have made. Manchester City equipped themselves fantastically, proved that they were organised, well drilled, the quality when they needed it, whereas Arsenal just imploded against Chelsea. I certainly think Arsenal are getting better at dealing with certain things, but I still think there's some way off. Certainly, some way off being able to challenge Chelsea for the title. I think the other thing as well is City played most of the second half without Carlos Tevez. Now he scored, I think, 36 goals in 54 Premier League games for them. And they haven't struck upon a formula when he's not there that enables them to win. I mean, I know Adebayor scored a hat-trick in midweek, but, he's seriously flattered to deceive in the league for City. And I think when they lose that focal point that Tevez provides, they occasionally look short of ideas. I mean, obviously, it's nice to see Balotelli coming on. I think he will make a difference to them. But so you're looking at all those things and weighing all those things up. I don't think City did too badly, really. And 3-0 was probably an unfair reflection.
Tom, let's go back to Arsenal. Being very nice about Manchester City. Nasri had a great game. Does this mean that Arsenal are not a one-man team anymore? Because, although Fabregas played well, I think most plaudits went to Nasri. Is he coming of age? Can Arsenal afford to have Fabregas injured again? Did it mean something in those terms, at least for Arsenal?
I think Nasri's getting better and better, and he's really picking up the slack. Arshavin has been a bit disappointing this season. I know Arsene Wenger said last week that Arshavin creates more chances than any other Premier League player so far this season, but for me he's been disappointing. And to have Nasri looking so bright and lively and standing up to the physical challenge, creating as he did in fits and spurts last season, he should only get better at his young age. So I think it's very positive, and Nasri plus Fabregas is formidable.
Can we just go round the panel? Shamak versus Bentner. I mean, Bentner comes on. He's been out with a groin injury. While he's been out, he's been getting more negative press than if he'd been actually playing. It's as though his reputation has deteriorated while the poor bloke's been on the treatment table. And he looks like a natural striker, whereas Shamak looks a little bit clumsy. Who ultimately, when they're both fit, should be the first choice striker, do you think, Matthew?
I think it's difficult to say, actually, which I know is a bit of fence sitting. I rather admire Bentner, and I know that he isn't short of self-confidence, and he's quite quick to articulate it. I thought he took the third goal very well yesterday, and I think somebody as canny as Wenger will probably play with both before he comes up with a definitive view as to who is the better player.
James?
I think Shamak's only 2.5 months into his first season in England, so it'd be a little bit harsh to draw too many definitive kind of conclusions. I think I'd like to kind of see how he copes over the season as a whole. Bentner has, there are times when he's looked absolutely terrific, but he just has this remarkable ability to kind of be sublime on occasion and utterly ridiculous on others. And I think he's certainly got the talent. I mean, you can understand why Wenger's persisted with him, and I certainly think he's worth he's worth kind of giving another go. But it'd just be nice to see some consistency from him. But obviously, Wenger's now got a dilemma as to whether he opts to play them in tandem or stick with one up. And then obviously when Van Persie comes, I think the big one is for Van Persie to come back as kind of as capable as Bentner or Shamak might be on the day. I think they both are inferior to Van Persie.
Tom, what should Wenger do with his strikers?
I think Chamak's got far more potential than Bentner. Bentner looks good against average opponents. When it comes to real top-quality defenders, he goes missing, misses quite a few chances. Okay, he'll score against a 10-man opponent. When there's no pressure, when Arsenal are going to win anyway, but I wouldn't trust him for the really big games. I don't think his movement's intelligent enough, and I don't think his shot accuracy is quite good enough either. I think Chamak is good in the air, good movement, all round, huge amount of potential, and I think he's got a lot more upside than Bentner.
Right, well, no arguments about the sending off, although I have to say, I think if you watched it closely, it was probably a yellow card, not a red, because I don't think it was a clear goal scoring opportunity. But then I like to throw in my all when it comes to the refereeing decisions. Moving on to Liverpool's victory at Anfield. I was there. I have my bottled water with pictures of Jamie Carragher and Stevie G on it with me to prove that I was there, and I will be keeping that bottle of water for a very long time, because it's rather attractive, actually. It was interesting. In the press room after the game, there was an awful lot of head scratching. People who were there to analyse, write reports, they didn't know what to conclude. Obviously, there was an overwhelming temptation to say Liverpool have turned the corner, Roy's got them playing decent football, but Blackburn Rovers were really rather pitiful, particularly for the first 45 minutes. And I just wondered, and Liverpool are still in the bottom three, they need to score at least three or four more goals to overtake Blackburn on goal difference. And I think probably if they'd got out the bottom three on the day, bigger conclusions would have been drawn, and it would have been more fireworks about the result. But the fact remains, Liverpool did play really well, but they're still suffering from what Roy calls we're in the bottom, we're in a false position, and that makes us nervous sometimes. So are any of you chaps able to draw any conclusions from a pretty decent victory over poor opponents? Tom?
I think Blackburn are pretty ordinary away from home, especially against so-called bigger clubs. So I think it's far too soon. Yeah, Blackburn are the kind of team that Liverpool should be beating with ease at home. Okay, it's encouraging, has to be encouraging that they played well, that Torres scored. That has to give them a lift, but we'll see how they do against Bolton this weekend. That'll be a truer test. And then the week after that comes Chelsea at home, which I want to see how they do in these next two games before pronouncing Roy Hodgson back to his managerial guru ways. I think there's a long way to go yet before we can say that Liverpool are really going to progress and move up the table to the top half, let alone out of the relegation zone.
Yeah, I mean, Roy yesterday, he wasn't keen to say the corner's been turned either. And for some reason, he took great exception to the phrase catalyst that we did. So I don't want to talk. I don't know what catalysts are, as though it was a trap, actually. But, I mean, it could be a catalyst, couldn't it, Matthew?
I think the conclusion that we can really draw is that Roy Hodgson is feeling it. The close-ups of his face when Liverpool squandered chance after chance, and particularly when Blackburn got an almost comic equaliser, it's as if he's having an existential crisis. The agonies of the damned were etched across his face. I mean, managers often understandably betray their emotions on the touchline, but Hodgson, who is a sane and rational and reasoned human being, he just seemed to have lost it. And some of the comments he's made, I think, are indicative of that. He's somebody whose knowledge is probably wide enough to know what a catalyst is, but he's suffering a blackout out there. And, he is such a seemingly decent man. I don't know him well, but I almost sort of wish for Liverpool's resurgence just to see Hodgson come back to some kind of emotional equilibrium.
He can be a bit moody, though. I remember even last season when Fulham were doing well, he attacked a chair in the dugout at Craven Cottage and gave it a whack when something went wrong. So I think all managers have got that inherent potential for violence and fury, no matter how urbane they might be on the outside.
James, can we take anything from that yesterday?
I think the only kind of... I mean, they obviously got 3 points, but I think the big thing was Torres scoring again. How people have gone from kind of eulogising him to kind of berating him, saying he's finished and all this kind of stuff. I mean, there's some seriously kind of heavy criticism of him, which is kind of been knee jerk in the extreme. I mean, he's patently not been fit. He's clearly was very upset with how the ownership situation panned out, and obviously until John Henry came to Liverpool's rescue, so he's obviously had some I think he's been in a bit of a sulk, really. But with the exception of Drogba, I don't have any other striker leading my front line, so I think that's going to be the big positive. I mean, I'll kind of slightly echo what Tom said. I mean, Bolton are unbeaten at home this season, they're eighth in the table. Owen Coyle's fashioning a very solid-looking team. I mean, Christ, even Johan Elmander scoring again. So I could see Liverpool drawing or losing to Bolton next week, and then I don't give them a cat in hell's chance of getting anything against Chelsea the following week. So we could be in a situation where they might take, a point and still be firmly in the bottom three or four, a fortnight later in, this victory against Blackburn looks a dim and distant memory. So I think... we'll really know till Christmas with Liverpool. They just look so flaky. I mean, I look at the defence and the kind of midfield in front of them, and it's just, it's just the shadow of kind of former Liverpool teams. And the problem is, I mean, Kyriakos, Skrtel had pretty decent games yesterday, but they can be dreadful at kind of any point. So there's just not a great deal of backbone in that team. So I don't have a great deal of confidence that this is definitely a corner turn.
But do you have confidence that Torres is back? Because I find it slightly peculiar that he would, just because there's a new owner at the club. Apparently, in training in the past week, Torres has been looking more sprightly and smiling more. he was happier on the... I didn't think he looked like his old self at all, but he was happier out on the pitch on Sunday. Is this just because there's new owners, or what? Why do you feel that
no,
Thomas
well, I mean,
might be...
I think going back to... I think he was given certain assurances that the ownership would definitely be changing a lot sooner than it ended up doing, which was one of the reasons why he agreed to stay on in the first place. And obviously that failed to materialise, and he probably, you know, felt he'd been sold a dummy. So, you know, and look, I mean, he's won the European Championship, and he's won the World Cup with Spain. The guy wants to be winning the kind of big trophies, and he, you know, is probably thinking, did I make the right decision staying at Liverpool in the summer, because they look further away from being able to win silverware than they ever have. So, you know, I mean, I just think he might have been made... He's probably given certain assurances that weren't met. It's only now, as we approach November, that there's been a change. But, you know, I mean, you know, what's he going to win at Liverpool this season? I mean, I certainly think that's why, you know, there's still going to be a hell of a lot of debate about his futures, you know, as to whether he'll still be a Liverpool player next season.
Maybe that's why his picture's not on the Liverpool FC official bottled water. I don't know. Matthew, do you buy it? Do you buy that now? I mean, Matthew, you have studied in your book, Bounce, you have studied why people make it, what makes them special in sport. Do you buy into this thing that players actually... that Liverpool players are going to be playing better and have a spring in their step because the ownership debacle's been resolved?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I certainly think that the equilibrium of a sportsman can be rather fragile, and certain outside influence can have an effect on it. I would be astonished if the reason for Torres underperforming because of his concern over the ownership issue, and now it's been resolved, he's going to start playing well again. I think it just could be another explanation. He had a temporary and rather inexplicable loss of form. I agree with James. He's a rather wonderful player. And you can see that across, if you take, you know, his entire career in context. No, I mean, if it is the ownership issue that has been his problem, then I think that really is a worry. And I think it means that his psychology is rather too fragile.
It doesn't have to be one set of reasons, does it? I mean, I think there'll be a multitude of reasons. Oh, also, you've got to remember, Alison, he's playing with a lot of dirge. You know, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, Jovanovic, you know, Rodriguez, I mean, Joe Cole, I mean, you know, they've all been very poor, you know, and the kind of Lucas Poulsen is a shadow of the Mascherano Alonso axis. So he's got Steven Gerrard behind him, and he hasn't got a great deal else around him. So that's clearly going to, you know, I mean, you know, put Drogba in that team, and you know, he's still, you know, on form, he'll still obviously be very good, but he won't be nearly as potent as he is for Chelsea.
Tom, where will Liverpool finish this season?
10th.
Okay. And we'll end it there.
Maybe 9th, you know. Let's be optimistic.
Okay, this is not Radio 4, but we are going to discuss a moral maze. Who cares most about football? It has been an ugly few weeks in the game, where the intentions of Wayne Rooney and his agent have been called into question, where Portsmouth have been held to ransom, and where Paul Gascoigne and Andy Carroll have been arrested. Throw in aggressive masked fans at Rooney Towers, Liverpool's takeover saga, stabbings in Italy, and the bribery scandal at FIFA. Could the game have lost all its morals? So, who cares most about the game? The FA, agents, the clubs, the players, the fans, or the media? Can any of these groups see themselves as moral guardians of football? And where's the game going? How can it be saved? There's quite a lot to answer there. But, Tom, go on then. What's wrong with the game, and how can we make it better?
I don't know if you can lose your morals if you never had them in the first place. Maybe you could go back to the Victorian era, where there was a Corinthian spirit, perhaps pre-professionalism. But once money creeps into the game, and when the game gets ever bigger, then there'll be people will obviously be motivated by selfishness and greed. You know, all these human failings, which will take priority above a sense of solidarity and ethical considerations. You can't blame agents, clubs, players for looking after their own interests. That's only natural. It's just a shame that the FA aren't stronger guardians of the game and appear to have let the Premier League take the upper hand in regulation to such an extent that the FA have very little power or inclination, it seems, to actually do what's in the game's best interest and stop money and rampant commercialism from completely eroding the values which we all want football to have of spirit, you know, fair play, equality, and positivity. And positivity. It's just a. I don't blame Rooney for taking the money. Why wouldn't he? When in the climate.
It's not like someone just came up to Rooney while he was sat at his desk, looking through all the broadsheets and assessing the current financial parlour state of the economy and wondering what he might do to help. He went out of his way to engineer more money. There's a difference between saying I don't blame someone for taking an improved contract. And
as you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Someone manipulating the fans of various clubs, and his own manager and his own teammates to get it, isn't it?
That's par for the course these days, isn't it? Every transfer or every contract becomes a saga played out through the media, with everyone having their say, negotiations, brinkmanship. It's just the way things happen these days to eke out that extra 30 or 40 or 50 grand a week that Rooney so desperately needs.
Matthew, it sounds to me like Tom's quite fatalistic and you can't have morals where there's money. Is he right?
No, I disagree entirely with Tom on that. I mean, you just have to look at the attempted experiment in communism, if I can bring a political analogy in, to see that when you abolish differentials in money, corruption just re-establishes itself in a different form. Human nature is selfish and people are self-interested. We are often at base rather greedy. It's a pretty natural human impulse. And football, in the pre-professional era, there was corruption. You only have to look at the early years of the International Olympic Committee, when it was managed and governed under an ethos of amateurism, to see that official corruption and dubiousness and cheating amongst athletes was pretty much the same. It's a constant theme of humanity. I mean, just to turn Tom's argument on its head, if you look at the most recent cricket scandal where Pakistani players are alleged to have spot-fixed particular matches, the argument was entirely inverted. People said that the Pakistani players were prepared to cheat in order to make more money because they weren't earning enough legitimately from the game. So, I mean, I disagreed with that argument too. I don't think it's an issue of money. It's just an issue of human self-interest. Where I take issue with Rooney isn't in his deciding to try and earn as much as he possibly can. That's something that all of us tend to do. What I didn't like, and Tom alluded to it, was he did it in a hypocritical way. He tried to dress up his mercenary tendencies in the sort of garb of high principle. And that's something that happens a lot, because the central mythology of football, of course, is that it's supported by partisans, bankrolled by fans who care about the clubs in a way that sort of extends beyond financial self-interest. But it is played by and run by mercenaries. But I think that the selfishness and the corruption and all of those things, it exists in rugby, it exists in cricket, it exists in all sorts of other sports. The reason football gets it in the neck is it's just so much more much bigger, and people have so much more interest in it.
Ooh, James, step in. Which side of the fence are you on?
I,
Having written 13,000 words last week in this whole sordid saga, I'll kind of start with Rooney. But the one thing I will say is that as horrendous as the whole thing is, I still don't think it equates to the greed that the bankers exhibited, you know, bringing this kind of country to its knees. I think they take greed to a whole new level. And I certainly think, you know, there's still a place for, you know, morals where money's considered. I mean, look at Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. I mean, they've got more money than anyone, and they still believe morality is very, very important, and the prove that you can have both. But I mean, on Rooney, to subject a manager like Sir Alex Ferguson, who has bent over backwards for that player time and again in his private life. I mean, obviously there've been the prostitute allegations, you know, now, but they were obviously before. But he's had a lot of other personal issues that haven't kind of come to light. He's bent over backwards for him at that club, and I think when you make a decision that you want to leave a club like Manchester United and leave behind a manager like Sir Alex Ferguson, you have to think very, very long and hard about it. And when you go to them and say, I want to leave, then you stick by that decision. Because, you know, Rooney's well aware that he's playing for the most high-profile club. He's the biggest footballer in England. And he's playing for the most famous manager around. So he knew the slew of headlines he was going to invite. And so you go into that. Anyone with half decent, you know, bit of decency anyway, would stick by their decision, having thought long and hard about it.
So, James,
to drag the club through what he did, and then turn around and pocket, you know, £200,000 a week, I just found it absolutely disgusting.
Do you actually believe that Rooney really wanted to leave United? Well, so just look, a ruse to up his salary, because he didn't feel he was going to get enough renegotiation.
I mean, I think obviously money is a huge thing, but he didn't. The initial offer that United were making, which was a basic of well north of £150,000 a week. Apparently, Rooney and his agent didn't even look at that offer. They didn't even want to countenance it, because they were saying, "I'm going, I'm gone," which kind of give some, and that's kind of come from the United side, which I believe far more than the Rooney side, and that kind of gives some credence to thought. Well, maybe Rooney's looked at the squad, doesn't think it's very good, looked at the fact that United aren't buying big name players and spending a lot of money, and also is wondering if the manager's still going to be there in 12-18 months' time. He's thinking, do I really want to sign up for this for 5 years? On the flip side, you know, has his agent thought, you know, I can make a killing here if he joins Manchester City or whatever? I'll get a big slice of a transfer fee. We'll get a lot more wages. Wayne will be happy. We'll get a lot more wages, and go from there. I mean, I think money's been a massive factor. I certainly think, you know, Rooney's looked at the squad and that it plays to part of his thinking. I certainly don't think it's the main reason, which he, you know, claimed it was.
Is it okay to just pick up on a couple of the points you made for a moment? Because they're very interesting points. I mean, firstly, on the Bill Gates, and I totally acknowledge what you're saying. He devotes a great deal of his personal wealth to charity. But let's not forget, the reason he made so much money is because he was incredibly single-minded in pursuing the profit motive, in precisely the same way that Rooney and Stretford have done. So presumably, we would regard Rooney as a pretty decent chap if he maximised his own income by taking money from the club, but then donated it to the third world. So in that case, we should sort of reserve judgment and see what Rooney does with his windfall, I guess. But the other thing, you mentioned his lack of loyalty to Ferguson, but are we to believe that the reason Ferguson helped Rooney out of his troubles in his private life and over prostitution was out of the kindness of Ferguson's heart? Or would we rather believe, is it not more realistic to believe, that the reason Ferguson bent over backwards is because he knew he had an asset who he could exploit for the further success of Manchester United and his reputation? In other words, Roy Keane was right about this. If Ferguson thought Rooney was something less than a very good player, he would have sold him.
he would have been perfectly happy to have left him out to dry. The idea that there is some altruism in Ferguson's behaviour, wouldn't you agree, James, that's slightly unrealistic?
The difference, I think, often with United and Ferguson is that they're probably the last club, really, where you get players staying for a very long period of time. I'm not just talking like in 3 or 4 years. You get a lot of players who stay there for 8, 10, 12 years, or in the case, obviously, Giggs and Scholes and Neville, it's like 20-odd years. And you know, you speak to so many of his former players, even some of those that you know that were big names, and towards the end of the career, he kind of ruthlessly kind of cut off because he decided they weren't good enough, and they all talk so fondly of him, and not just what he did for them as players, but how he brought them on as people. Now, obviously, you know, some of Ferguson's players morally, you know, the past, you kind of look at them and thought, well, he's not done a particularly good job there. But I do believe that for a lot of his players, you know, it's more than just, you know, kind of exploiting them because they're assets and that kind of thing. I think he has a genuine kind of interest in how they develop as people.
So if then it would have been in Wayne Rooney's best interest to stay at a club that knows how to look after players, and you're right, James, it has a good track record on that. Let me ask Tom this. Does that mean agents are at fault because they have no moral framework for operation? This is purely commission. They do not consider this boy I represent, this young man I represent, his mental health, his career, his happiness in life, and all that goes with having a good life and a good career. He'd be better off staying with someone like Alex Ferguson, but doesn't, because it's all about his commission.
Some agents do think only about the money. Some agents think about the overall welfare of their player. There are some good and some bad, but you've got to look at the player knows himself best and knows his own mind best. If the player's listening to an agent who is only motivated by money, then the player needs to be stronger and realise that the agent's primary interest could well be selfish and could well be just to get him the best deal. Equally, these days you have perhaps a culture where money equals respect, and so although the sums are ridiculously large, perhaps for Rooney it might have been a matter of having parity with the very best players in the world would be a status symbol to him more than the actual fact of having a bit more money in his bank account. I think it's difficult to generalise about agents. They get a very bad press, but mainly speaking, their job is going to always be what's in their client's best interest. And generally speaking, in a short career where there are opportunities to earn huge amounts of money, that will be the primary focus. And I just think players themselves need to think a bit more and be a bit stronger, and don't blindly take advice from the agent if they suspect that the agent is just leading them down a mercenary path.
Matthew, are we in cloud cuckoo land thinking that players have the maturity to think about what their agents might be doing and to assess their careers in a more level-headed way?
Well, I think, I mean, let me just acknowledge totally what Tom and James are saying in one respect. I totally agree that the charade that was perpetrated on fans and upon the public was very distasteful, and I hate the hypocrisy. I think it's legitimate to have a go at that. But yes, these players have very short careers. They are in the ball game of securing their financial future and that of their wider families. Part of it, of course, is about making sure they play for a team where that they can get success, and that they may be interested in winning lots of trophies and getting personal glory, and even when that means they'll be earning slightly less money. But I think, you know, when we say Rooney shouldn't be exclusively interested in money, what we're saying is he should play for Manchester United and earn slightly less perhaps than what he's worth. But remember, this is a transaction, not between Rooney and the fans. It's a transaction between Rooney primarily and a private limited company. And if Rooney plays for less money than he's worth, that just means that Manchester United, the company, will have to make less debt repayments, or will take a higher dividend, one or the other, or a bit of both. In other words, the purchasing party is also financially self-interested. It's not just Rooney as the selling party that is self-interested. Football is just a branch of modern capitalism, nothing more, nothing less. And the fans are people who are not just normal consumers. You know, we support a team not just because the meat pies are particularly tasty or because they play the best football, but because we feel a sense of genuine identity. But the fans, if you like, are the are the outliers in all this. Every other party in football is in it for essentially more than anything else for the money.
Well, the truly incredible bit is that Wayne Rooney is paid probably, it seems, 200 grand a week, and I think he's past his best. Okay, it is time for my favourite Times writers to get off the fence and give a straight answer to the week's big stories. I have with me a ceramic hedgehog whistle, which sounds like this, which I will blow. It's a girly version of Marcotti's various musical instruments, if you babble on too long. Tom, does Avram Grant have what it takes to haul West Ham to the giddy heights of mid-table mediocrity?
I suspect not. I was at the game on Saturday and West Ham were excellent for the first 20 minutes and abject for the rest of it. The one thing you could say in Avram's favour, he's got great experience of being bottom with Portsmouth last season, so if anyone knows about being last place, then it's Avram. There's just no will, no energy, no drive, no sense that West Ham can change the course of a match through the manager's tactics and his force of personality, because there just doesn't seem to be that force there. And when the team is borderline relegation quality already, you're looking at the manager and he's just not inspiring them.
That's a no then.
I fear not.
James, Gary Neville was fortunate indeed not to be sent off against Stoke. Is he using thuggery to compensate for pace, and when on earth will he retire?
Well, he was fortunate, and he even admitted that himself. I think it's worth remembering that he's barely played this season. It was very, very ring rusty, and Matthew Etherington exploited that. I wouldn't say it's quite thuggery. He certainly been catching a lot more players later than he used to do. But I mean, I think this will be his last season. I mean, he did think that the previous season would be his last. Maybe he's gone on one season too long, but you know, hey, the guy's made 600 appearances for United. He's had some career.
James is a Gary Neville fan. Matthew, I heard you on Radio 2 this weekend, which is weird because I never ever listen to it. So you must be in it all the time if I just happen to tune in for the first time in 20 years, and there you are. And you were talking about the importance of Muhammad Ali's politics. Are today's big sports stars scared to hold an opinion?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, there's no doubt at all that Ali symbolised the unhinged radicalism of the 1960s, and he did pronounce on the great and defining political issues of that time. Sportsmen and women today don't really say anything, and there's a good reason for that. They want to earn as much money as possible from big commercial endorsement contracts from multinational companies, and they know that if they say something which alienates some of the consumer base of that multinational, they're not going to get another contract. And so we do have very sanitized, very anemic athletes today. And it's interesting that even Muhammad Ali, he sold his commercial rights for $50 million, but still retains a 20% stake in the holding company. He doesn't say anything anymore. You know, he didn't say anything about the Iraq War, about Obama, about any of the sort of the great defining American political issues of today, because he knows that to do so would compromise his earning power. So top sportsmen and women have really become the poster boys and girls of modern...
Beautiful answer, but too long. Tom, are Newcastle actually happier away from St James's Park?
I think they are. They've only picked up 4 points at home and had a couple of poor results compared to 7 away with last Saturday's win over West Ham when they looked excellent. Tyneside, and it's a cliche to say it's a pressure cooker and it's a wild atmosphere and the heat. I know it's a terrible cliche, but it does appear to be true. And last week's rumours surfacing that Chris Hughton was under pressure already just adds to that impression. It seems that Newcastle can't cope with a bit of stability and a bit of, you know, quiet and a bit of dullness and for too long. There's got to be some excitement, there's got to be some turbulence there, otherwise it's unnatural.
I think you're right. Hughton definitely looks happier when he's doing the press conferences away from Newcastle. James, will the rumoured player clear out at Old Trafford actually happen this summer?
Yes, I mean, as I understand it, up to 10 players will be shipped out next summer. Obviously some of those will probably retire, like Neville and Van der Sar and others, like Hargreaves are out of contract, but I believe the likes of Wes Brown and Michael Carrick will be bombed by Lord Ferguson, and I think he's looking at signing five or six players with Jordan Henderson, Jack Rodwell, David De Gea, Atletico Madrid goalkeeper, and Anders Lindegaard, a Denmark goalkeeper. I believe those four players are figuring prominently in his thoughts at the moment.
Thank you. Matthew, Roberto Di Matteo was the most pessimistic of all Premier League managers when the season began. Will he really be surprised, though, that West Brom is scaling the heights?
I think he'll probably be a bit surprised. I think he's surprised a lot of us. They are clearly more organised and have more defensive understanding now than they did previously. But it's always difficult to say at this stage of the season whether their success is temporary or a trend.
Oh, that was such a contrast. That was beautifully brief. Thank you.
And one for you, Alison. Peter Crouch is hardly prolific in the league, so why does Harry Redknapp persist with him?
That's a good question, Tom. The Spurs fans seem to get on Crouch's back. He sort of looks terribly clumsy. He had chances on Saturday against Everton that he did not take, but he has forged a Beauty and the Beast relationship with Van der Vaart, and I think for as long as he gives Redknapp the option to play a long ball. And somehow, in his own way, Crouch makes it lovely, and Van der Vaart has the intelligence to make something of it. I think he will persist with him, and I think he's correct to do so.
And Liverpool would have him back in the shop.
Probably they would. Thanks for your time. Please go to thetimes.co.uk for all the news, gossip and analysis you'll need. On our web chats, including Gabs every Monday. That's when he's not off sunning himself.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.